Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Mallory Mercer, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement for the STAR Coalition. On this podcast series, we're going to shed light on some of the most stigmatized and misunderstood areas of the mental health industry. Our hope is that through this podcast, we can bring transparency and light to a system that is so heavily scrutinized. We aim to share vital information about a multitude of mental health topics while spreading the message that research equals hope. Today, we sit down with Steve Michio, who is the Chief Executive Officer of People USA. He's inspired and driven by his personal lived experience and has spent over two decades creating, providing, and promoting innovative crisis response services and system-level improvements. He works across the United States and internationally and raises the bar on customer service, person-centered communication, trauma-informed care, empathy, and positive expectations for people's recovery and wellness outcomes. These unique models and approaches significantly reduce hospital utilization, incarceration rates, and overall healthcare spending. Welcome, Steve. I'm so excited we get to speak with you today on the topic of respite housing and the importance of stabilization for individuals living with mental health diagnoses.
Thanks for having me, Mallory. It's nice to be here.
Well, Steve, before we even start, will you break down exactly what respite housing is and why it's so important for our listeners who don't know?
Yeah, respite housing is, I always describe it as a bed and breakfast with a lot of love put into it. It's something that people can go to when they're experiencing a crisis of some sort, and where they traditionally may have gone to an emergency room or a critical care facility, they can come to us at our house and stay up to 7 days and get 24-hour peer support. They can also, it's also focused on looking at crisis differently for those individuals. And a lot of times the goal of why I created the respite the way I did was to help people break that cycle of going home to crisis to hospital, home to crisis to hospital. It's a self-referral house where people are called guests. They do a registration instead of an intake. We've changed language to make it more humanistic, I think, and more compassionate for folks. So guests come to the house. They are welcomed into the house, very friendly, very compassionate kind of entrance into the house. And then from there, we work on looking at their crisis, what brings them there. We don't look at diagnosis or talk about that much unless the guest wants to. And we offer them a safe place to deal with that crisis while they're with us, but look at alternatives to how they can address those in the future.
All of that is so wonderful and rare, I think. You know, you and I talked a lot before this podcast on what sets your respite housing apart from other treatment options. And I think you absolutely just answered that. I would love to know, and I think everyone would want to know, how do you measure the success of your respite housing? Is there any data that you guys have collected?
Yeah, we do collect data. That was important to me to do it because when we first got the house approved, people didn't understand what it was. And so I knew I'd have to be able to show and explain the efficacy and the value of the house. One thing we don't do is we don't just get people to come and then just they leave and then we don't stay connected to them. We try to stay connected with every guest that comes to our houses. What we do is collect research and data on the quality of the stay itself. So we do a satisfaction survey, but we also do an 8 dimensions of wellness survey to see if it's changing anything in their lives after staying with us and also after following up with us when they come to the house to see if it's made a difference. And what we find in our research and data is that it does make a difference in people's lives and they don't utilize emergency rooms. But even further than that, they start to really focus on their own recovery in their own way. And that's through the support that we give them after their stay at the house, during and after the stay at the house, to ensure that they're on a path of self-determined recovery, you know, a choice by themselves to figure out, okay, this is what I want in my life. This is where I want to go. And the house helps a lot of people do that in moving forward. So we do have data in addition to the demographic data and the different, you know, the diversity of the people we serve in the data. We also measure why people come to the houses. And interestingly enough, they're the same reasons that many people go to hospital emergency rooms. We're happy about that because it means that we don't have to always follow a medical model of medication and strong clinical support and therapy for individuals that come to the house that are dealing with crisis. So we do collect quite a bit of data to measure the overall success of the house.
And I know that everyone wants to know, what made you come up with this wonderful model? Why did you see a need for this?
Well, I actually saw the need for something different when I was hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital. And the way we were all treated there was, for me, a very strange environment to go into. It was traumatic. It was being given medications that I didn't even know what they were or understood them. Following this routine of going to a group every day and just being led by a clinician and talking about, you know, what was wrong with us, not what was happening for us or to us. And I thought there could be something better because I also recognized that a lot of people didn't necessarily take or need the medication, you know, that they were may have been prescribing when I got to know a lot of different folks. I searched when I started writing the proposal for the house, I spoke with Sherry Mead, who had a respite in New Hampshire, and it was similar to what I wanted, but I wanted to do something even a little more than what she had been doing. And I wanted it to be available to the community, whether we knew you or not. In Sherry's model, she wanted to get to know the guests before they came to the house, and they didn't always stay overnight. In my model, I wanted people to be able to come to the house immediately, stay at the house, and benefit from what we could offer them by staying at the house. So that's where it came from, though. It was my trauma, my experience that kind of led to what we've created now.
I appreciate your openness on that subject. And, you know, I want to know, the data is overwhelming that once someone is hospitalized for their condition, they are bound to go back at some point. So with your respite housing, are people allowed to come more than one time and utilize your services?
Yeah, they absolutely can come more than one time, and we welcome that because we also have to think about their history, their life, their experiences, and what they've been through. And if they've been someone that's used the hospital emergency rooms and inpatient settings over and over, you're not just going to fix it in one visit. So we are very open to additional visits. And the way I train the staff is that as long as we're moving towards the progress of recovery and wellness for that individual, and they're willing to do that, that's perfect because that's what gets people to break the cycle of overuse in hospitals and even overuse at the houses. The Rose houses are natural warm lines, and many times former guests will just call just to get support. They don't have to come in, and that's a beautiful thing too. You know, we were there for them either way, and so absolutely allowing people to come back, I think, is important.
Wonderful. And you mentioned your wonderful staff. Tell me about the training that you put in for them, because it's not your typical model. How do you specifically train them for their roles and prepare them for the success that you have?
Yeah, we do a lot of training for the staff. They get a whole training on the peer movement, peer support, you know, where we came from, how we were developed, what's important to us, what our values are. We do a lot of value-based training in our values as an organization. We do the training of, you know, A to Z of when a guest calls the house and wants to come in to when the guest leaves the house and how they follow up. So we had to create that training. It didn't exist really anywhere. And we realized that there were some very strong components that we had to include, which was a trauma-informed environment. We had to include the engagement itself and how friendly we are to the people that come to the house. The most important piece that we have in there is the lived experience, the mutuality. You know, being able to share mutuality at the appropriate time with a guest is important, because you always want the guest to feel and know that they are the most important person in front of us or at the house. And we don't ever want staff to feel like they got to tell their story if it's worse than theirs or anything like that. So we get the judgmental kind of thought process and behaviors. You know, we take care of those immediately so that everything is about the guests when they come in. We also provide suicide intervention training to the staff. We provide motivational interviewing to the staff. Dialectical behavior therapy for groups is given to the staff. Anything we can do in the trauma-informed world, we have a whole trauma-informed training itself that they go through before they can even work in the house. And then they have to go through a mentoring when they get hired and start working at the house for about 2 weeks, where they are following a staff or a mentor through the house and learning, you know, the documentation, the engagement, the shared, you know, lived experience, conversations and things. So it's pretty extensive. And then it continues. You know, we don't just stop at the one training. They continue to get training through other networks and through other providers and through other, you know, trainings that come up. And if we feel they're relevant to the house, we will put the staff into that as well. So there's quite a bit that they go through.
Sounds like it. So with that extensive training, can you tell us where the funding comes from to provide that?
Yeah, it comes from a few different sources. When we first started it, it came from the New York State Office of Mental Health, where they funded it entirely. It was way too small of a budget. It was only about $240,000 to run a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour service. But that's where it started. And then a couple of counties saw the value in what the house was doing after we had been open for a few years. And they went to their own county legislation and got funding approved for it. In addition to, we picked up additional funding from the state to make it feasible to run the houses. And now it's been so successful in New York that the state recognize the value of the house. And I don't know if it's a fortunate thing or unfortunate, but they put it under a Medicaid model. And so my fear was if we moved to Medicaid, we were going to lose the values and become more medically based. The thing that we did, though, is we hired the right consultants to help us not lose any of those values for the people that come in, still do the billing, not have to be as prescribed in medical note taking and medical, you know, data collection as traditional Medicaid is. And we've been successful in moving to a Medicaid model and making it even more sustainable because of the Medicaid funds that are coming in. So it's a benefit to the community. And we made sure that we didn't lose any pureness, any values that we hold to our hearts. And it's been successful. So now it's a few different funding streams that are helping it to be successful.
And I know that you are in New York and People USA is New York based. Tell me a little bit about how communities and states would benefit from something like People USA. What has your state seen as the impact of having something like People USA and being willing to fund that?
The impact is pretty tremendous, which we didn't realize. There's a cost avoidance to having people come to the Rose houses compared to going to traditional crisis services. Each house, whether it's a 3-bedroom up to an 8-bedroom, can save or have a cost avoidance of between $6 million and $12 million a year. That gets people's attention. What gets my attention is how we're treating people and how their lives are going. But the funders, you know, of course, are going to pay attention to the savings. So through that, you know, we've been talking about it more in national conferences and international conferences, and we've been helping others throughout the nation and in the Netherlands design, develop, and open respites in addition. So it's been kind of a be careful what you wish for. We didn't plan on getting in the consulting business, but we are now. And what's nice about it is that we can help other communities and other peer programs and providers open these houses. And I think it's been a great journey in helping so many do that.
Absolutely.